John Ortberg has notably said that nobody gets the life that they wanted. And what he means by that is that when we are growing up, when we're young adults, or when we're imagining what our life would be as we get older, as we get into adulthood, we imagine all kinds of things. We imagine our jobs, our relationships, or what our family might be like, our careers, what success is, how our lifestyle will be, what experiences we will have. And to a certain extent, many of us would say, some of those things that I thought one day I would have, I do have. Some of the things that I thought I would experience, I do experience. Some of the achievements that I hoped I would be able to make, I have. But also some of them don't. Some of them don't come to fruition the way that we thought. And even if to a certain extent some of those things have happened to us, inevitably interruptions occur. Things don't unfold exactly the way that we had hoped or in the time that we would have expected them to. And we experience all kinds of hurts and pains, betrayal, failure, loss. We have unanswered prayer, unexpected circumstances, illness, things that creep into the way that we thought life would be and interrupt it, make it so that it wasn't exactly what we thought. Sometimes it's far from what we thought or even what we had hoped. Often these things are accompanied by seasons of fear or pain or disappointment. And the question is not so much whether you will experience some of those interruptions. It's not if you will experience some of those interruptions, but when you will experience some of those interruptions in your life, because those things happen to all of us. And oftentimes we would say, well, I'm just trying to lead a life that leads to happiness. I just want to be happy. What do I have to do, even in the midst of all of those things, to be happy? And there's a researcher and author from Harvard, fairly well-known at the moment, named Arthur Brooks, and he recently wrote a book called The Meaning of Your Life. And his argument is that many of us are searching for happiness, and oftentimes what we mean by happiness is actually pleasure, is that we want to feel good, and so we search for and try and get the things that we think will make us feel good most of the time, or as much of the time as possible. And many of those things are sort of short-term things, the things that, again, in the moment might make us feel good, experiences that we have, the vacations that we have, the money that we can get, the success that we can experience in a short amount of time, comfort, achievement, productivity, entertainment, all of these things we try to optimize for our happiness. And of course we do, because those things aren't bad things, they're good things. And in many ways, they enrich our lives in so many ways. But what his argument is that what we're actually starving for, what actually is what we really need and what we have a huge deficit for in our lives and in our culture today is actually a crisis of meaning. We live lives that lack real, deep, profound meaning, or at least we're not able to articulate what the real purpose and meaning of our life is. And so in his book, The Meaning of Your Life, he argues that human flourishing actually requires three things. One is coherence, that your life forms a story that actually makes some sense, that you could look at your life and say, this actually, there's reason for this, and I could talk about that. Secondly, purpose, that your life is directed towards something beyond immediate gratification, because when we get those immediate gratification feelings, they can be wonderful and great, but they're also fleeting and they come and go pretty quickly. And then ultimately, significance, that your life matters and contributes to something that is larger than yourself, bigger than just you. And today, the story that we're going to read, I believe, is ancient wisdom that points to what someone like Arthur Brooks, who studies neuroscience and biology and culture and all different things, I think confirms many of the conclusions that he's coming to, but from a perspective of wisdom that has lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I want to talk about three lenses to frame our perspective and our lives, whether things are going really well or whether they're not, whether you're struggling to wonder why things are going the way that they are. Maybe you're going through a difficult season of pain or hurt or struggle. Maybe things are going really well, but three lenses to form our perspective that I think are lasting and help to point us towards a more sustainable view of our lives. And so today, the story I want to tell is the story of Joseph. If you caught the last message in this series, we were talking about Jacob, and Joseph is one of Jacob's sons, one of 12 sons that Jacob has. And so we're now going one generation below the story that we talked about last time in our last message, and we're talking about Joseph, one of the sons of Jacob. And I'm going to start by giving a bit of a survey of Joseph's life, some of the main points, the big highlights and lowlights of his life and things that he went through. And what I would like you to do as I do that and as I walk through some of these stages of his life, I want you to be thinking about how many of the circumstances that Joseph went through that you can identify with. You can say, oh, I felt like that. I went through something like that. And of course, as I talk about his life, it won't be the same types of things specifically. You're going to think, oh, I've never done that. I've never been there. His context is hundreds, thousands of years in the past, and he went through all kinds of things that I would never even be close to. And yet, some of the feelings and the emotions and deeper experiences of those things, I would love for you to just evaluate and say, oh, that didn't happen to me, but something similar happened to me, or I had similar feelings. And just as we go through it, love for you to be keeping sort of an internal check and to say, oh yeah, I felt like that. I've been through that. Oh, I went through something that made me feel like, I'm sure, what Joseph felt like there. And then we're going to get to, after we've kind of collected some of those experiences, those three lenses that maybe can help frame our experiences and our perspective of the things that we've been through or the things that we're going through, or maybe to file them away for times when we will go through them in the future. The story of Joseph, notably, in large part starts with some dreams that he had. Joseph, like I said, was one of 12 brothers, and he was his father, Jacob's favorite. In fact, he got favoritism from his father. Some of you will know Joseph, the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. The play, the musical, the whole deal comes from this story, comes from the fact that he was the favorite son, and his father even gave him this big fancy robe to wear that made him stand out amongst his brothers, who did not love that he got all this fancy, wonderful treatment. And Joseph, early on, he has a couple of dreams. One of the dreams is that there are 12 bundles of wheat, and the 12 bundles of wheat represent him and his brothers. And in the dream, 11 of them, which are his brothers, bow down to the one, which is him. The second dream that he has is of the sun, moon, and the stars, 11 stars, that also bow down to him. And he goes on. And of course, he has these dreams and he interprets these dreams as, I'm the one that everybody's going to bow down to in my family. And as a young man might, he goes and he tells his family and he tells his brother of these dreams and of these interpretations, basically saying to them, I am going to be the rising star of the family, and you will all one day bow down and serve me. And as you can imagine, that doesn't go really well in the family. He starts out as kind of this cocky, overconfident, arrogant kind of person with an outlook on life that even by these dreams, oh yeah, everybody, and it's not just that he has the dreams, but it's how he acts based on them, and he talks about them and tells his brother, and this is what's going to happen to you. And so, of course, his brothers decide that they're going to do something about that. They don't like it. They don't like being talked this way. They don't like the way that he's talking about their future and their family and their role in it. And so they decide that they're going to kill him. And so they throw him in a well. And they decide as they throw him in the well that maybe they shouldn't kill him. Maybe they could just leave him for dead. We won't actively kill him. We'll just leave him here. And eventually he's going to expire. And as they're kind of figuring out exactly what to do with him, they see some traders coming down the road and they decide, oh, here's an even better idea. We can sell him. We can sell him to these slave traders who are going to take him off our plate. And so that's what they do. They sell him, and then they make it look like an animal has attacked their brother, so they can go back to their father and say, Father, this great tragedy has occurred. And your favorite son, Joseph, he's gone. And they, you know, bring his clothing with animal blood on it. You can see that he's gone. And his father is distraught and wails. But, you know, they've done away with him. And so Joseph, at the early part of his story, is betrayed, literally sold out, and abandoned. And by the people who are closest to him, by his family, totally turn his back on him. They literally sell him. Abandon him, leave him for dead, or eventually leave him to be enslaved. There's a couple of times repeated in his story, this little phrase, especially as Joseph goes through some really difficult times, that says, but the Lord was with Joseph. And so Joseph gets taken by these slave traders, and he gets taken down to Egypt, and he eventually gets sold to Potiphar. And Potiphar is this wealthy Egyptian officer. He's obviously got a big household and lots of land and lots of business to take care of. And Joseph becomes one of his slaves, one of his servants. And the Lord was with Joseph. And Joseph works hard, and he does well, and he gets promoted, and he gets promoted, and he gets promoted. And Potiphar is looking at this guy saying, wow, he's amazing, and he does all the right things to the point point where he promotes him to the head of his household, the head of all of his business affairs. He takes care of everything that he wants to take. It's like Potiphar has made him his right-hand man. And you say, wow, in this story, what a turn that has taken. His brothers abandon him and sell him and leave him for dead. But now he works his way up from being a slave and a servant all the way to the top of the household. And people take notice. And Potiphar's wife takes notice. And she's got eyes for Joseph. And she makes advances on Joseph. She wants Joseph. And he says, no, I can't do this. Your husband, he trusts me in everything. And of course, this is terribly wrong. And she keeps pursuing him. And she wants him to come to bed with her. And he refuses. And eventually, there's a time where she grabs him by the cloak. And she's trying to coerce him. And he kind of wiggles out of his robe. And he runs away, leaving his cloak. At which time she starts screaming and making a big deal and accusing him. Oh, he has forced himself on me. Well, obviously, Potiphar gets furious, and so he throws Joseph in jail. Joseph now, after being betrayed, sold out, abandoned, works his way up to the top, is misunderstood, misrepresented, falsely accused, and punished. Finds himself in jail. In jail, he finds himself with Pharaoh. So Pharaoh is the leader of the Egyptian empire, and his chief baker and his cupbearer are also in jail because they were in the bad graces of Pharaoh at the time. They have dreams, and we're finding out that Joseph, he has this ability that he always says is from God to interpret these dreams, and so he says God can interpret the dreams, and the baker and the cupbearer both have dreams about themselves and come to Joseph and say, Joseph, can you help us interpret these things? And the interpretation for the baker's dream is not good. Joseph says it's going to get worse for you. In fact, you are going to be executed. You don't get back in Pharaoh's good graces. To the cupbearer, he says, good news for you. After 3 days, you are going to be reinstated, actually. And this is actually what unfolds, that he's right about the interpretations of the dream. And as the cupbearer gets back into the good graces and gets released in his freedom, it's kind of like, hey, when you get out, don't forget about me. And the cupbearer, he's like, I'll never forget about you. This great thing, you interpret this dream. You're amazing. You're awesome. And he goes and he gets free and he forgets about Joseph. Joseph is forgotten. For 2 years, two whole years, he continues to sit there in jail, to suffer, until Pharaoh has some dreams. Pharaoh has a dream that there are seven big cows, big, you know, well-fed cows, and there are seven scrawny ones. And in the dream, the seven big, full cows are eaten up by the seven scrawny ones. And then he has another dream where there are these big, full heads of grain, seven of them. And then there are seven scrawny ones, and the seven scrawny ones eat up the seven big, full heads of grain. And Pharaoh, he's trying to figure out, what in the world does this dream mean? And he goes to his own magicians and the people that are supposed to be able to interpret dreams for him, and nobody can interpret it, and he's kind of going crazy. And all of a sudden, the cupbearer goes, oh, I remember this guy I was in jail with. He was incredible, and he could interpret dreams. Maybe he can interpret your dream. And so Pharaoh goes, and we get Joseph out of jail, and he interprets these dreams. And Joseph interprets the dreams. He says, here's what's happening with these cows and the wheat. It means that in Egypt, you're going to have, and the surrounding area, you're going to have seven really good, amazing years of crops, and it's going to be wonderful, and everybody's going to be living the dream, and you're going to be sitting there in luxury because of, you know, everything's blooming, you've got tons of grain. But after the end of the 7 years, there's going to come 7 years of famine. And so that's the scrawny cows eating the bigger, well-fed cows. That famine is going to eat the luxurious comfort life that you've been in, and you're going to go without. And Pharaoh thinks, wow, this is so wise. This is so amazing. And so Joseph gets promoted up the ladder again, and he gets put in charge of everything again. Oh, how wise it is. And so they start saving up their grain and saving up the grain and saving up the grain. So at the end of the first 7 years, when hard times come and famine comes, all of a sudden they go, wow, this is really tough. But guess what? We've got tons of grain sitting around because we've been saving it up. Joseph has been so great, so wise for us. He interpreted these dreams. This is amazing. We are totally fine and things are good. And here's Egypt sitting pretty in a great position, even though all the peoples around them are in famine because they don't have any grain. And this is where Joseph confronts his past. When the famine spreads beyond Egypt, Joseph's brothers, you know, they're living not so far off, are in famine, and they don't have a whole store of grain. And so they decide that they need to come down to Egypt in order to buy some grain for their people so that they don't starve to death. And so his brothers come down, and they show up, and here's Joseph. He's now this high position of leadership in Egypt, and they come to meet with him, and because he's dressed up as an Egyptian, and of course a whole bunch of time has gone by, they don't recognize that it's their brother that they're talking to, and they come, and they fulfill the dream that Joseph had once had, when they bow down to him in their greeting. And they come asking for grain. And Joseph uses this time. Remember, if you've been listening along, especially with last week, and we talk about this as a family who has a family history of some trickery and deception, is that Joseph sees this sort of as a time to play with them a little bit and to test them a little bit. And so he recognizes his brothers, even though they don't recognize him, and he accuses them of being spies, and he questions them about their family. And eventually he demands that they go back home and they get their youngest brother, Benjamin. Benjamin was the other favorite son. And for their father, Jacob, having lost Joseph, Benjamin was like this valuable, love him so much. He didn't get sent in the first meeting of them to go on into Egypt. And so as Joseph questions his brother, he kind of demands that they come back. And so they come back and they bring Benjamin, and Joseph continues to test them, and he welcomes them to the big banquet, and he treats Benjamin so well, and they come to an agreement about, yes, I'm going to sell you some grain and all this kind of stuff, and they send them on their way. And then Joseph comes behind them with a group of people, and he catches them as they're going away, and he says, hold on, I think something's missing, and he searches their stuff, and he had hidden this very valuable goblet, his own goblet, in their stuff and some other stuff, and he goes searching through Benjamin's stuff, and he says, oh, we found my goblet. You guys are stealing from me. You've been stealing from me. This is all a trick for you, and they're all caught off guard, and they're freaking out because they didn't actually steal stuff from him, but now he's accusing them, and he's bringing them back, and he's saying, now we're going to take Benjamin, and Benjamin's going to be my slave because he's got to pay for what he did. And in this moment, you have this moment where all of these brothers, remember their history? They had actually left, abandoned, and then sold their brother Joseph into slavery. Now their other younger brother, Benjamin's been brought in, and he's stuck, and he's been now falsely accused, but they don't really know. And he's going to be sold essentially into slavery. And you got to think, Joseph, man, his wheels are turning because this is a story that he's already heard. This was my story. And when I was in trouble, you guys just gave up on me. You abandoned me. You caused my trouble. And now their other brother is in trouble, except this time one of them stands up, Judah. He stands up and says, no, don't take Benjamin. I'll take his place. And in that moment, you could see probably so many emotions flowing around Joseph, you know, thinking of what he's been through and all that led from what his brothers did to him and all the hardship and all the pain. And now here's Benjamin. He's kind of set up this whole scenario, and they come, they actually come to his defense and say, we'll stick up for him. We will take his place. And he just like breaks down and weeps. There's just so much going on. So in a nutshell, Joseph was betrayed, abused, sold out, abandoned, misunderstood, misrepresented, falsely accused, punished, forgotten, and overlooked. If you look at the circumstances of his life and through this story, he spent his time, listen, there were some ups and downs, some extreme ups and downs, actually. He spent some time in a pit. He spent some time in prison. He spent some time working his way up. He spent some time falling all the way down, being enslaved. He found his way back to being successful again and being in charge. He found himself confronted with his past, with his family, with the hurt that had gone back and forth, with some of the root causes of what led to all of those circumstances, a life that he never would have imagined, many of those things that he never would have expected, he never would have wanted. How do you interpret a life like that? A life of the mixtures of ups and downs, successes and failures, joys and hurts. Joseph's life, you might say, at this point, ends up fairly successful. Sure, but he's been through it all. And so I want to come to this passage where after a little bit more time has passed, all the brothers, their father dies, Jacob dies, and the brothers get worried because they think, Maybe Joseph has kind of had some grace with us up to this point because of our father. But now that our father is gone, they kind of come to him and they go, oh, maybe we should be worried because now maybe Joseph is going to get his revenge for all that we've done for him. And Joseph's response, I think, helps points us to these three lenses that help us to interpret a life as he interprets a little bit in review. Now a little bit standing, he's not, when he does this, he's not in the pit anymore. He's not in jail anymore. He's not right in the midst of it. He's now removed himself a little bit, been removed from some of those circumstances. He's looking back on his family hurt and on his failures and also on his successes. And he's going to give a really, really powerful perspective that I think for us is a game changer. So this comes from Genesis chapter 50, starting in verse 15. It says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. I love that. They send a message. Hey, Dad told you to forgive us, right? You're going to be nice to us, right? Dad said he's not around anymore, but you're going to be nice to us. And it says, Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Of course he does. It's such a humanizing part of this story. He just weeps. All that he's been through, all the hurt, all the pain. Now their father is gone, trying to take that all in. Just so real. Life that can be filled with struggle. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear. For am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Here we go, framing our perspective through three lenses from that speech that Joseph gives that I think are helpful. First thing he says to them, don't fear, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Am I in the place of God? One of the ways to ensure that you live in bitterness and hold on to grudges and are unsatisfied in your life is to think that you know everything. Is to think that you have the full perspective on what's happened and what's happening and what will happen. To think that your perspective is the whole picture, to think that you know what you deserve, how your life should be and how it should turn out, how everything's going to turn out, what other people deserve and how their life should turn out, what should happen to them, and to think that you should be in control of all of that. It's where Joseph starts. I'm not in the place of God. In other words, number one, I don't see the whole picture. I want to acknowledge I don't see everything. You know what would be really easy for him to say is, I see all the pain you've caused me, you people. And I see all the circumstances and all the consequences that came with them. I was in a pit. I was in jail. I was falsely accused. I was away from my family. Pain, 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 pain. I had to do it all myself because you left me. You abandoned me. You sold me. But he starts by saying, actually, I don't see the whole picture. You see, when we think we know everything, that helps us to believe that we could sit in the place of being the judge. And of course, we don't see the whole picture. We don't know everything. We don't see people's hearts. We don't see our circumstances. We don't see what could have been in another scenario. We don't know what would have happened otherwise. We don't know the future. We don't even know all the things about the present. But when we step into that place where only God is, who sees everything, sees what's best, sees what could have been, sees what is, sees people's hearts, sees the consequences, sees... When we put ourselves in that position, it's easy for us to be bitter and to hold grudges and to be unsatisfied with what we think should be, what we think we deserve, what we think other people deserve. But that doesn't lead to happiness. That doesn't lead to peace. That doesn't lead to goodness. Usually it leaves us sitting with that bitterness in our own lives, with that pain, with nowhere to put it. And so Joseph starts out, I have a limited perspective I'm not in the place of God. I don't see the whole picture. Secondly, he makes this really amazing, powerful statement. You meant evil for me. You meant it for evil. And God meant it for good. I love this because, again, such a very real perspective. Could have said, you know, and everything's been a total write-off since then, since you sold me out. I mean, you've just done so many terrible things to me. You ruined my life. Could be overly pessimistic. You ruined everything about my life, and I never recovered. And all this pain and all this hurt is because of you, and I've been stuck in it, and I'm still with it. Or he could have been overly optimistic. He could say, don't worry about it. Everything worked out in the end. I ended up rising the ranks in Egypt, Potiphar's house. That didn't work out so well. But eventually in Egypt too, and everything's good. But he doesn't do either of those things. He lives in something that is so real. He says, number one, you meant this for evil. You meant evil for me. You had bad intentions for me. You threw me in a well. You threw me in a pit. You were going to leave me for dead. You sold me. You can come to terms with that. But here's something so powerful that God can be working for good even when things are going bad. And this really connects with the first statement that we made. I don't know the whole picture. The second one is God can be working for good even when things are going bad. If I think I see the whole picture and I think I know everything, the second one is hard to accept. But here we can accept this, that when things are going bad, God can be working for good. That I can look at my life and say some bad things happened and realistically looked at his brothers and say, and some of this was your fault, very much your fault. You meant evil for me. And at the same time, I can acknowledge that even in the pit, even in the jail, God was also working for good. That's the kind of God that we serve. Just because my circumstances aren't good doesn't mean God isn't good. God didn't leave me. God didn't abandon me. You may have, but God didn't. It's this great statement that God can use what he does not approve. This doesn't mean, so God wanted his brothers to sell him into slavery and abandon him? No, but it also means that God can work through things that he doesn't approve, that aren't good, that are evil. God can work through any situation, not because he brings about the bad, but because he can work through what he doesn't approve. He can use what he doesn't approve. We need to be careful, and I want to be careful here because if you're in the middle of a crisis, this might not seem like the most pastoral thing to say, God is working for your good, but just see the two things right here that Joseph says that I think just, again, are so real for us, so authentic, is to be able to say things are bad. Doesn't mean that God is bad. Someone's been working for my bad doesn't mean God is working for my bad. In fact, it could be that even in a situation that not even God wants you to be in, he can still work through them. That God is still with you. That God never abandons us. And this dual statement helps us from giving up and being defeated or being overly optimistic, whether life is going good or whether life is going bad. Thirdly, the third lens is that meaning means more. It's interesting that when Joseph says, don't fear, for am I in the place of God? I don't have the whole perspective. And then he says, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. He doesn't say, but don't worry, because everything's good now. It all turned out really well. Look at all the things I'm in charge of. I'm wealthy. I'm powerful. I'm important. He doesn't say, everything's fine because in the end it worked out. He doesn't say that at all. He says, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive. That it turns out that this wasn't about whether I was comfortable or pleasured or in a pit or in jail, or running Potiphar's house, or running Egypt. At the end of the day, what was really important is that God used my life and all of these circumstances, the highs and the lows, the goods and the bad, to save people. He looks around and sees, don't you see there was this great purpose? A great purpose that I wouldn't have seen in the pit and I wouldn't have seen in jail. And I might not have seen when I was leading Potiphar's house, and I might not have even seen if I let it go to my head that I was had this powerful position in Egypt. But he says, not at the end of the day, it's all okay because here I'm doing well now. No, at the end of the day, God has worked to do something even better, and he has saved many lives. There are people who are not dying from a famine because of all of these circumstances. In all of these circumstances, God continued to work. And so my life wasn't just about feeling good. It wasn't just about getting promoted. It was about the fact that God had something much bigger for me. That God is working all around us. And Joseph is saying, and I got to be part of it. We got to be part of it. And meaning means more. It means more than just feeling good. It means more than just being wealthy. It means more than getting a powerful position. It means more than today everything went perfectly, as if that's a realistic goal in life. Of course, it isn't. He finds real meaning. Meaning in his life. And this is what I think people like Arthur Brooks in his book and his research have found, is that it's easy for us to search for happiness. And what we mean by that is for everything to go really well, more often than it goes wrong, anyways. For us to feel good as often as we can. For us to have maybe comfort or luxury. For us to achieve the things that we've set out for ourselves. Oh, that's great. Oh, that's wonderful. I hope you experience so much of that. But meaning matters more. And Joseph found out, as he looked back on this life, as he looked back on all the hurt, all the pain, all the struggles, all the ups, all the joys, all the promotions, and he goes, you know what's amazing? At the end of the day, many lives were saved. And this is, I think, what Jesus was teaching when he taught us, and he was talking about worry, and he was talking about how we all worry about the things we're going to eat and the things we're going to wear. We all worry about the things in our lives that are going to make us comfortable and the things that, you know, the money and the clothing and the cars and the where we live and all these things. And he doesn't say none of those things are important. But he says, you don't have to worry about those things. And here's what he does say. This is the takeaway. He says, but seek first the kingdom and the righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. The kingdom of God. Seek first where God is at work, God's will all around you, the God of love, who is at work when you see him and when you don't. He's always working for good. He's always working for good. And Jesus said, there's a lot of things to worry about. I get it. But instead of worrying, because none of those things, a lot of these things are out of your control. Worry's not going to change any of that. Here's what you do. Number one, here's what Joseph was able to do. Seek first the kingdom. Look for where God's at work all around you, in your relationships, in your family, in your workplace, in your neighborhood, in your marriage, in your parenting. Seek first the kingdom, seek first the kingdom, seek first the kingdom. And all these other things that we worry about, and all these other things, and not to take away, that might be a real struggle and be a real hurt and be a real pain. That's part of life. And other people might be even causing you that pain. They might mean evil. But that doesn't mean God's not working for good. Look for where he is and join him there. And let him provide for you in all the other areas of your life. It's the message of Joseph's life. But even more, Joseph was in a line. The bigger, much bigger story wasn't just about famine in Egypt and around Egypt, although that was a big deal and he got to be part of that. But Joseph got to be part of the line and the descendants from whom one would eventually come who was also abused, literally sold out by one of his best friends, abandoned by all the closest people to him, misunderstood and misrepresented in his message, falsely accused and convicted, punished on a cross, forgotten and overlooked, the one who endured it all, and rather than fighting for his own rights or why everything wasn't fair and stacked against him, died hanging on a cross, doing what his ancestors Joseph did for his brothers, forgiving. And in forgiving, reconciling the world to God, Joseph was the ancestor of Jesus, who shows us ultimately what it looks like to seek first the kingdom of God, to give his life, trusting that even when things are bad and working for your bad, God is working for good. To save, as said of Joseph, many lives, to save much, much, much more lives, to save the world and to bring the world into reconciliation with God. And it is him who we ultimately trust, and in his way that we follow. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the story of Joseph. We thank you for his endurance and his perseverance and persistence. We thank you that we too can know that we can trust that you're working for our good, even when things are going bad. God, I pray for those of us today who are maybe in a real struggle, and it's hard to see that good could come out. Perhaps they feel like they've been abandoned, not only by people around them, but by you. I pray, God, that you would show up and show them that you always work for our good. You are working for the good of each one of us and for this world, that you love so much, and that we know that because you sent your son into this world to show us what love looks like, to show us what your kingdom looks like, to die for us and to forgive us, that we might know your love and know your goodness in our lives, wherever we might be at the moment. And so we trust you and we love you in Jesus' name. Amen.